Hi, welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and welcome to the show. My guest this week is Sean Garrity, whose directorial credits include Inertia, Lucid, My Awkward Sexual Adventure, and Blood Pressure. His new drama, Borealis, starring Jonas Chernick and Joey King as a father and daughter on a desperate quest to see the Northern Lights in Manitoba, just played the Canadian Film Fest and opens in Toronto this Friday, April 8th. It'll be rolling into theaters across the country over the next few weeks. Sean picked Naked Lunch, which is, amazingly, the first time someone's brought a David Cronenberg movie to the podcast. But what a great place to start, right? Released in 1992, Naked Lunch marks the start of Cronenberg's second act, when he found the perfect angle to adapt William S. Burroughs' counterculture classic in the subjective storytelling format he'd only flirted with in Videodrome 10 years earlier. As Peter Weller's drug-addicted exterminator Bill Lee plunges into the increasingly surreal landscape of the interzone and his own psyche, Burroughs' book and Burroughs' own life story fuse into a strange new form, a new thing that we know as David Cronenberg's Naked Lunch. Quite literally, then, this is someone else's movie.
I mean, there's so much to talk about with Naked Lunch, right? I mean, and it's one of those films that stuck with me since I saw it. I saw it, and like you, after I saw it, I very quickly then saw it again.
Yeah. You kind of have to.
Yeah, in a way, right? It takes you like one watch to sort of figure out what he's doing. But I mean, in a way, it takes you one watch to have the kind of the Burroughs work on you, and then it's like I feel on the second viewing you sort of get a clearer view of where Cronenberg is in the mix.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting. But I've always thought it's just, since I've seen it, I think it is the single best adaptation I have ever seen.
Of right? anything? Of Burroughs or of anything?
No, of anything. Okay. I mean, there's so many films. I mean, there's, you know, films in recent Canadian history.
Sure.
Where they take, a great novel and they just kind of copy and paste the prose into a screenplay format and then shoot it.
Yeah.
With great deference to the original material. But there's no adaptation. I mean, there are different forms, and part of what makes a work great is its form. And so I love the way that Cronenberg has taken the source material and really adapted it for the screen. Like, it's very much Burroughs.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's very much Cronenberg. It's a real adaptation. And, you know, going over it again, I was also really excited about how it's predates, you know, Kaufman's adaptation by 15 years,
yeah.
Right? But it is this metatextual, like,
yeah.
Watching the writer write the film that you're watching, kind of, it's, yeah. I mean, in rewatching it, there's just so much going on, and there's just so much to talk about in there, and the different techniques of Burroughs that he kind of employs, and the journey of the viewer through the film, which kind of feels like, you know, what you'd be reading the original work, yeah. And yet using Burroughs' life events as kind of this narrative glue, it gives you kind of a through line to stick with, which is kind of really necessary for cinema. And there's just tremendously tons and tons of very exciting stuff in the movie, I think.
Yeah, it is one of those films that I've always held up as an example of a movie where someone says, "Oh, this text is unadaptable," and mm-hmm. this movie proves it. Like, you can't actually argue that this is an adaptation of the book. It's everything as well as the book, and then fragments of the book bleeding into, as you say, into, mm-hmm. into Burroughs' life and back and forth. And it's done on a level of complexity that, I mean, this was the big indie boom had already started. People were willing to accept new cinema.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Drugstore Cowboy had come out a few months earlier. The world was ready for hallucinatory drug stories. And yet this was just like, so I saw it at the Cineplex screening room, this dinky little 35mm room in Midtown Toronto with, I think, 30 seats.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a packed house, and it just played to silence. Like, we just took it.
Right.
There was nothing to do.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny, and you could sort of giggle here and there, but not everyone laughed at the same jokes, which was sort of great.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of it, there was this moment of just absolute exhaling, where people just went, and you felt it leave the room, like you felt the movie end.
Yeah.
And Cronenberg, you know, like, he is a master of endings. He is a phenomenal last framer. Mm-hmm. He said famously in a Fangoria interview once about the Dead Zone, about how he wasn't going to put a happy face on it by saying, you know, like, I'm not afraid of movies that spiral into the inevitable darkness. And it's like, yeah, we know that now. but after, you know, like after the three films previous, after Dead Zone and The Fly and Dead Ringers, you're just, you know, what is the ending to this? Where are we going to get out?
Yeah.
And when he lets you out, he releases the audience without releasing the protagonist, which is such an amazing thing that he can do in that moment and just crush you, even though it's actually sort of okay. Like, this is the moment where it becomes all right for William S. Burroughs to write his book, mm-hmm. and all you are is glad to be away from it. it's an incredible release, and it's the kind of landing that he stuck and nobody else ever could. And it was so fascinating to watch that perfect moment and this whole crowd of film critics who presumably, I don't think anyone else had seen it either. I think it was the first time we'd seen it collectively in Toronto. And we were all just blown away by it. Mm-hmm. And then I immediately wanted to go and see it again. And I did.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And then the second watch, it's so much richer. And then, you know, a few days ago was like my third watch of this film, and there's still, going through it going, well, look at all this other stuff that I hadn't seen on my first or second watch.
Yeah.
It is such a kind of a rich text, you know? And when you say funny, I mean, I have not seen a Cronenberg film funnier than this movie.
Yeah, it's true. This is the one that has jokes all the way through.
Yeah.
Like, History of Violence has some actual laughs early on, and The Fly is kind of funny right up until it breaks your heart.
Right.
And then just goes darker and darker and darker. But yeah, this one is the one where it's like the thing that everyone says about working with him is that he is really dryly funny. I've interviewed him a number of times, and he can see the joke coming before you get to it. When you're talking in conversation, he'll just sort of jump ahead and get to it. And this is the movie that feels most like a conversation with a filmmaker, because he is totally aware that we are ideally totally aware of what he's doing. Like, the manipulations are right there on the surface, and we're allowed to enjoy them. Like, Crash is kind of funny too, but in a really uncomfortable way. Naked Lunch is much more blatantly like, this is the story of a man who cannot deal with his homosexuality. This is what he sees. He probably doesn't leave his apartment. And that, you know, that extra level of textuality is an accident because of the Gulf War. They could not go and film in Morocco, which was their original plan.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they had to do it on soundstages here, which, you know, like, Cronenberg is the most soundstagey filmmaker anyway.
Right.
It's perfect for him to stay enclosed. And he had said that, you know, like, I don't know why we didn't think of it already. Like, in the beginning, it didn't just hit us that, no, of course he never leaves his apartment, we should stay there. But no, they were planning to shoot on location, and everything got scuttled by the outbreak of hostilities.
Well, I thought that was I guess obviously it was a choice, but I mean, it felt like, because I knew somebody who was shooting something while he was shooting it, talking about these elaborate Moroccan souks that he was building in these sound stages, which is perfect for it. But yeah, especially in the first act, you know, the absolute deadpan reaction of his protagonist to the most absurd creations that Cronenberg can throw at him, and he just has the kind of the perfectly timed pause and then this dry little reaction. It keeps you in stitches for the first half, for sure.
Oh yeah, no, Peter Weller. I mean, we knew he was funny.
Yeah.
Buckaroo Banzai was years earlier, and he'd done RoboCop, which was this remarkable mime performance in the middle of this serious, like, serious ironic performance thing that he does in the middle of this great big satire. And then he comes out with this, and it's like bebop. Like, it's just like watching him play jazz.
Yeah.
The timing he has on that, just that slow burn about bug powder at the very beginning with Judy Davis. And it's just so weird and so great.
Well, and I feel that it's, but almost like an extension of Peter Weller's performance, the other elements that are not, you know, absurd and bizarre are so stand, like, it's not a darkly lit film.
Yeah.
Despite the material, it's very kind of, it's lit a lot like a kind of a 50s sort of, you know, almost like a Hitchcock, like those bright Hitchcock films.
Yeah.
And, you know, the way that they're dressed and the set dressing, all of it is so kind of normal and bright and low key that to then have this dichotomy with all of this, you know, really dark, weird material. Yeah. Is it almost like extends the reaction of Weller out into the set and out into the mise-en-scene that makes it, I find it just very, very funny.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, what can you do when faced with a typewriter with a talking anus. That just you. I mean, it's the movie. The movie actually gives you time for a double take. I think the way that it's introduced, you have the shot of Clark Nova, and then a reaction shot, and then back to that thing, and it's a bit closer and a bit better lit. And
yeah.
It's like, oh, okay. This is actually a thing that's happening. Yes. And the film's absolutely not. Like, it doesn't care if you aren't keeping up. That's what's so great about it. For me, is that Cronenberg is just like, no, I got this. There's a confidence to the film that just sails past all of this bizarre. I mean, somebody shoots someone in the head in the first 20 minutes, and it kind of gets shrugged off.
Yeah.
Because nobody's really capable of responding to it. And it's not, like, the film itself is not narcotized. The film is completely aware of what's going on, but we are filtering our own reactions through the way, because we look to the people, the audience looks to the actors to see how to respond to something, and the tone is just so perfectly maintained that we have to wait, we have to see where this goes, because I don't think anybody knows in the film. Let's just write it out.
Well, and this is the other thing I think that makes it such an admirable film from my perspective, and where I look at it and say, oh my god, this is a film that I love and want to talk about, is how bold it is, how daring it is to, I mean, this is not an inexpensive movie.
Yeah.
Right? By Canadian standards. I mean, it's a very big, big film. And that Cronenberg would just so unapologetically make this film that really you kind of have to watch twice to just get into it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, today, who do you have working at that? I mean, Guy Madden, maybe?
Madden.
Right?
Madden, I mean, almost, he's so disinterested in narrative. Like, in conventional straight-line narrative, that I don't even know if he'd want to do something like this. Like, The Forbidden Room is stories within stories within stories within stories that just spiral back inwards, and then the joy of it is watching them come back out again. And with Naked Lunch, you really just go, like, to the classic Cronenberg line, you go all the way through it to the end, and you see what's on the other side, and then you're left there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, he simultaneously manages to hold your hand and abandon you in this world at the same time and just say, okay, find your way out. I have cookies on the other side of the door.
Right.
Can you find the door?
Yeah.
But it is like, so I jumped ahead of my first, the question I wanted to ask, which was, when did you first see it? How old were you? Like, what point in your development did you see
it? Oh, yeah, I would have been, was I out of university yet? I was not out of university yet. And so I was in school and I saw it in a theater.
Okay.
And I just was completely, again, blown away by it and how, again, how daring it was and how unexpected it was. And, but it had a lot of elements that I was just really, I'm very interested in very literary films, which, you know, this is quite literally a literary film.
Yeah.
And I was very interested in, you know, this kind of exotic, the travel films, the films that take place like a lot of those old Hitchcock films did in some, you know, in Morocco and wherever else. And and so all of those things had me go to see it. Actually, I may have even seen it. Now I'm thinking 1991. I may have actually seen it in South America. I lived in South America for 2 years doing film school in Buenos Aires. And I think part of why I saw it was also because it was a Canadian film.
So you just drawn.
I was just like, it's a Cronenberg film. It's a Canadian film. I'm going to go see it. And then those other things kind of dawned on me when I watched it.
Okay. How did The Room take it? Like, how did it play? Do you have a vivid memory of it?
No, I do not.
Yeah.
I do not remember how The Room took it. No. I mean, I saw it with my film student buddies. I do remember that. Okay. And they were as jazzed by I was, you know, as I was by the newness of all of it, the kind of the imagery and the stuff that left, like, I mean, it's a film that leaves you talking, right? Because you're kind of talking yourself down from the experience as well as just kind of, I think, unraveling the text.
Yeah, it's exactly. If I had seen it alone, I think I would have just gone and curled up in a fetal position somewhere. You need to get it out. You need to talk it through.
Yeah.
And, how long was it before you saw it again? Or was it?
No, it was like within a week,
like,
or
a
two.
Boomerang, yeah.
Yeah. Like, I wanted to see it again right away.
Yeah.
And so I saw it a second time, you know, in cinemas. And then I think I read something about it. And subsequently what I became most excited about, which wasn't my initial thing, of course, was this, again, the adaptation and the incorporation of, you know, not only the imagery from Naked Lunch and some of the narrative events from Naked Lunch, but then later on I discovered, you know, even Burroughs, his cut-up technique and his intention of how, you know, readers would experience his books. And certainly on a first watch, I think there's a lot of that experience for the viewer of the film.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask if you were familiar with Burroughs beforehand, because I wasn't quite as familiar. I mean, I knew who he was, and I had read... I think I'd read Junkie, but that was it. And I'd seen him in Drugstore Cowboy, which was that beginning of his renaissance, although the film Naked Lunch was already underway when that film was released. And yeah, it's... The adaptation becomes even more impressive when you actually understand where it's coming from, because that book is not filmable. I mean, I already said that, and I'm pretty sure I'm right. It's not incomprehensible, but if you actually did that movie, it would be... I think Cronenberg said this, it would have been like $70 million, and it would have been 5 hours long, and no one would want to see it.
Right.
I'm sure I'm getting those numbers wrong, but it was similar to that. And he's right. There is, like, it's not... possible, but maybe it is now. Maybe HBO could do it, you know, like as a miniseries,
right? But then who would watch it?
But a palatable idea, a palatable adaptation of that film, of that book, as is, probably impossible, unthinkable.
Well, but yeah, palatable for sure. And I mean, again, we get into this question of adaptation, right? I mean, I think all of those, like when Cronenberg's saying an actual adaptation or an adaptation, he means, again, taking the text, dumping it into a screenwriting program, and then just trying to shoot it.
Yeah.
Which for me is not really, I mean, it's not, there's no real adaptation there. It's almost like just a straight translation from one medium to another.
Right. And that would be just people getting high in rooms. It would be boring.
Yeah.
Like, I think.
Right. And I mean, part of what makes the book, I haven't read the book, but part of what one assumes makes a great book great is the fact that it's a book. And that your experience of it is the experience of reading a book. And that's a very particular kind of experience. And it's very different from seeing a movie. And I have long sort of, I've been involved in a couple of projects in development where we're adapting from another medium. Mm-hmm. And I've just been very adamant always that, you know, to adapt means to change. And that's just absolutely necessary if you're moving from one to the other.
Yeah. I mean, it should be ultimately. Elmore Leonard's a great example of somebody who wrote fantastic dialogue, but you still have to prune it. You still have to shape it. You have to know what will work cinematically, which is why you can point to Leonard films that work and Leonard films that don't.
Mm-hmm.
Burroughs, for a book about heroin and opiates, it's got this jittery energy, and part of that is the narrative, and part of it is the reader trying to figure out how pieces fit together. You're an active reader the whole time. You need to know what's going on.
Right, an experience that's exactly the same with the movie.
Yeah,
obviously, right?
And the film just straps you down for 2 hours and throws things at you that you have to put together. But it does find a tone and a narrative strategy that's right. Like, it feels like the book, even though it's an inquiry into the book.
Yeah, this is the thing, right? It's almost like an homage to the book in a way.
Yeah.
That references at the same time, it's almost like it's got a DVD behind the scenes feed, like the life of William Burroughs part of the film, which is just part of what makes it, you know, incredible.
Yeah, and the crazier it gets, the stranger the imagery gets, the more, you know, profane and scatological and then just weird the patterns emerge, and you can understand it. And then the second time it plays like a comedy, because you know it's okay. And this is a thing that constantly comes back to me as a film goer, as just somebody who watches movies, that there's always a second viewing of a great film is going to be more entertaining, even if it's tragedy, because you can relax.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that. And, you know, I could go see, the example I always use is Gross Point Blank, where I spent the first 2/3 on the edge of my seat going, please don't fuck this up.
Right.
Please come out the other end. I know this is great. Just keep going and don't blow the ending. And it found a way through, and it was fantastic. And
right.
Galaxy Quest The Force Awakens even more recently, where it's just suddenly, oh, they know what they're doing. And then the second time you go see it, you don't have that hesitation.
Right. You can just savor it.
Yeah.
Right.
And you know it's going to be great. I mean, I took people to see Naked Lunch. I think I must have seen it 3 or 4 times theatrically. The second time was another press screening. It's one of the only films I've seen twice before it even opened.
Mm-hmm.
The other, I think, was The Tall Guy, right around the same time, because I had the time to see movies twice if I wanted to. But I would take people who hadn't seen it and kind of just listen to them watch the film for the first time, because that was really fascinating in its own way.
Right.
You know, it's one of those moments where it's like, oh, I'm probably a little bit of a sociopath. I want to feel your tears. I want to see how you experience this. But it is just a remarkable movie to throw at people, because how do you process that the first time? And then you get to figure out how I processed it. And it's such an unyielding work, like the first time through. It gives everything up on repeat viewings. And as soon as you understand the larger concept, which clicks the first time through, everything opens up. But it is just one of those movies that says, no, you you have to come to me.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna dumb this down. I'm not gonna make this easy. And that, like, that's that second phase of Cronenberg's career that started with Dead Ringers, where he just didn't care about making something accessible.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, nor should he have, because he was going in a direction that just wasn't gonna have that.
Right.
But
so, and yet very Cronenberg. I mean, I saw this interview with him that has always sort of stuck with me. I went through a real Cronenberg phase. And
read, oh, how can you be a Canadian filmmaker?
And not have read his book, and, you know, went back and saw the films that I hadn't seen. And there was, and I saw an interview with him where he said that for him, a monster wasn't really scary. That's not really horror for him, a monster. Mm-hmm. That's action. For him, horror is when you are the monster,
right,
or you become the monster. And I always looked at that as his kind of central, like, as an auteur. You sort of take that then and you go back to each one of his films and you apply it and you're like, yep, fits History of Violence, it fit. Like, every single film, that concept seems to have a central place.
Yeah.
And this one as well, right? This guy sort of realizing gradually aspects of himself that he at first finds monstrous and then has to embrace.
Yeah.
And there is that embracing of the monstrous all the way through the film. All these elements that he introduced and that are horrible, like the typewriter and the mugwumps and everything else, eventually. I mean, one of the things that I love about a lot of Cronenberg, especially that phase of Cronenberg, you know, Crash and whatever else, is that he starts you at a place that is universal, brings you in step by step, and you find yourself, you know, an hour into his film watching someone, for example, in this case, you know, sucking liquid out of the head tentacle of a mugwump, and you're like, yeah.
It seems like
about polite. The right
That's
thing.
That's what you do.
Sure.
Yeah.
There's, you know, he brings you to a place where stuff that is just out there seems completely normal, and you can derive sense and sort of meaning out of it without shock.
Yeah. I think that his strength as a filmmaker is that even before that, like Naked Lunch, I think, is the first time that it really flowered, this thing he'd been doing, which is the bulk of horror films or psychological thrillers will have a normal character on the peripheral action. There will be a friend or a relative who says, you know, like, this isn't right, this isn't you, listen to yourself. And it's not a cheap device, it's expected. It's just, it's required by the genre at this point to have, like, a lodestone to show people how far the character, you know, like, Dr. Frankenstein, really? you know, when we were at school together, there's always that character. And it's right there through The Fly. And even Dead Ringers has Claire Nouveau, who says, like, I'm not putting up with this anymore, and leaves and precipitates the actual third act tragedy, which is the entire movie. but Naked Lunch, for the first time, it's for the first time he dispenses with it. But I think that Bill Lee is that character. That's
right.
The function he serves to himself. He is the scientist experimenting on himself, like Seth Brundle.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also the guy going, oh, that's probably not a great idea to shoot this stuff up.
Right.
Maybe not. And then do it anyway and see what happens and write the report. He's his own auditor of the experience, which is so weird. And then stuff like Crash or even in Butterfly, there's no one who's telling the prime.
Right, there's no one with them.
No one with the protagonist going,
You could argue in Naked Lunch that the Ginsberg Kerouac characters, I can't remember their names actually in the film.
Oh, the ones who show up and leave.
Yeah. They are, to a certain extent, are like that, but they're either so periodic in it. And even they're at the edge, right? I mean, they're there having sex with his wife and, you know, shooting bug powder at the beginning. And
yeah, my first thought is Ian Holmes Bull's character, but no, he's all the way in. Like, he's ahead of him.
Yeah, he's completely in. Even though he doesn't seem that way. There's a lovely classic Cronenberg. When you first meet him, he doesn't seem that way.
Yeah.
But then the more you discover about him, the more monstrous he becomes. But you're right, and I think part of it that's great is that usually when you see a character in a film that's kind of lost, there's a certain viewpoint from the outside,
right,
and we get access to their emotional distress. But you don't get lost with them in the way that we get lost with the protagonist in this film. Like, I think part of why he seems so on top of it and allows us in so much is because we're completely lost with, right along with him.
Yeah.
We're kind of looking around going, what? It's the typewriter is talking to me and this is so odd.
Yeah.
Right? And there isn't that sense of stepping back from him and looking at him from the outside that would encourage passing, you know, judgment passing or whatever else. You're like, you're right in there with him, right inside the labyrinth.
Yeah. It's sort of a precursor in a way structurally to Existence, which is somebody staggering around trying to figure out what things mean.
Yeah.
And having the audience
be kind of the same level. Like, we're with Lee. We're not ahead of him at any point. I mean, towards the end, I think once you understand what he's seeing and why, then you can start to make sense of things just before he figures them out. But then you get to watch him catch up, which is even funnier because Peter Weller can do that.
Right.
His eyes go dark and light up, or just his eyes go dim and then light up again in a really delightful way.
Yeah.
Which is the only word I can think of for his performance in this film. Man was born to wear those hats and suits. And totally. God doesn't know it.
That makes you, like, when you're watching the film, you start to think, how would people take me if I walked around in that thing? Because that looks really good.
Yeah.
That's like a comfortable, lovely looking suit. Why don't people wear those anymore?
It is kind of remarkable that Naked Lunch makes heroin chic, like, looks stylish as opposed to grunge. I mean, it looks great.
Yeah.
The costumes are phenomenal, but they're also part of the construction, the idealization of his situation, because probably he doesn't look that good.
No. Well, that's it. And there are a couple of, I mean, I only noticed on this watch that there are a couple of, because I guess he's green screening out the window, or I'm not sure if this movie is old enough that he's actually using matte paintings out there.
Probably a couple of mattes, and man, there might have been some green screen. I mean, it was in use. It was around.
Right.
Certainly if the film was as expensive as that, and it would have seemed like a cheaper solution than shooting in Tangier.
Right. Yeah, of course. But I mean, so most of the time you're looking out the window at Tangier, but I just noticed on this last watch that there's a moment where he goes over to the Ian Holmes character's apartment and they're in Tangier, but when he goes to the window, it's New York City.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Not a mistake.
Yeah, of course. You're not.
Very clearly a little tip of the hat. Like, doesn't he shoot up immediately after that? Like, he's coming down? Or am I misremembering? It's been about a year since I've seen it last.
He's there to, he doesn't shoot up right after that. He's there trading the typewriters.
Okay.
Right?
So he's already past that point.
Yeah, yeah, he's got the Mugwump head typewriter. He's trading it for his original,
right.
Who then Cronenberg goes on to deliver this touching, lovely death scene for this with music
and Clark Nova, yeah,
and this cockroach talking out of its asshole, and he delivers it this beautiful scene of that's great.
Yeah, and again, like there is no boundary. We're with him. We're not outside of that scene. The second time, I guess we are, but the first time through, it's just like, no, this is weirdly moving.
Mm-hmm.
And this hideous thing is sort of not hideous.
By that point, anymore. It's his best friend.
Yeah.
It's like, it's our best. He's been with us since the beginning of the movie, like, unlike every other character.
Yeah, it's like a puppy.
Yeah.
Hideous, hideous puppy. But that, like, that has always been his strength, too, as a filmmaker, is to take you into the most profane, mutilation is the wrong word, but the most profane use of the body.
Mm-hmm.
I saw Crimes of the Future in stereo in a theater once at the Bloor.
Wow.
Yeah, the 16mm screenings, it would have been like the mid-90s probably.
Mm-hmm.
And the sound was terrible and the prints weren't in the best shape, but people were into it. Like you, I assume you've seen them by now. These are
the one-hour films.
Oh, they're on Blu-ray now. They're, mm-hmm. they're around. They've been relatively well restored. And one of the things in Crimes of the Future is that this character has created a guy, Dr. Anton Rouge, has created a disease called Rouge's Malady, which is a thing where people become sexually frantic, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
They go into this sort of seizures and excrete fluids mm-hmm. from their nose and mouth, and other people are compelled to lick them.
Right.
Lick the fluids, not the person necessarily, but
right.
the stuff. And it becomes this weird, there's a moment where you're either with the story or you're not, and a character does it in the most kind of exaggerated physicality, and the room, like, people don't laugh at it. You kind of want to, but then you think, well, at this point I guess I could see that happening. Like, you're just in that world and you can't get out.
He takes you in step by... He meets you at the door at the beginning of the movie and then just takes you into that dark room step by step, right?
Yeah. It's a remarkable thing that he's always done. Like, he treats this stuff with this flatness, with this sort of documentary approach.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that in my head is amplified by the fact that he protected for full frame. So if you saw stuff on VHS, you didn't feel like you were missing anything. You were looking at an open matte image instead of a pan and scan frame.
Right.
He's never shot in scope and he's always made sure his films would look right.
Mm-hmm.
At 133, even in 178, now with DVD and Blu-ray, that's no longer an issue. Everything looks like it's supposed to look. But there is a confidence of composition, even in the worst presentation, where you just think, this shit is happening. Like, this is all happening in front of the camera. And the fact that he uses practical effects whenever possible, even now, puppets and things in History of Violence for people getting bludgeoned.
Mm.
He doesn't shy away from letting his actors have a tactile interaction with whatever's going on, and that somehow connotes to physical behavior that we believe. So,
well, for sure, if it's Peter real Weller, for the actor in the moment, it's going to be real, right?
So Peter Weller and Ian Holm and Roy Scheider unzipping himself out of people, it's just, it's all happening. And so why wouldn't we believe it? And you've already created this universe where I'm buying it. And the again, the score too, which we didn't even talk, which we've been meaning to talk about, the fusion of Howard Shore, his sort of strings of dread that he does with Ornette Coleman being just absolutely manic.
Yeah, very staccato. Kind of the soundtrack of the Beat Generation that went away.
Yeah,
right? That sort of
40 years later, he brings that to life in a really immediate way that makes you a hostage. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't matter if you don't buy it; it's happening.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I that's all for me very much part of putting you right back into, you know, within 2 minutes of that film, I'm like, I'm in 1955 and I'm part of the Beat Generation in New York City. Like, I'm there.
Yeah. It is it's a remarkable accomplishment on virtually every level, and the fact that it was made in Toronto by someone who had just had like 3 back-to-back commercial successes.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like this was the only time he could have done it, and he'd been wanting to do it for a long time. Like, there's a number of books that he had struggled to adapt historically. Crash was another one where it's just like the line, the fortune had to miss. No, he had the misfortune of not being able to get them produced the first time through. He was going to work on Total Recall, and it would have starred Richard Dreyfuss in 1983, and that didn't happen. And so he made The Dead Zone, which let him make The Fly, which let him make Dead Ringers, and then finally Naked Lunch, and he had a shot, and people didn't quite get it on a global scale, so he went and did M. Butterfly, because that was respectable, but that was too weird, so then he went back to crap. Like, there's that window in the 90s where he just did whatever the hell he wanted, and had to. I like, you feel like you're watching a guy burn himself at both ends to tell these specific stories at this particular point in his career. And Naked Lunch was like the first salvo of...
It really feels like the moment where things kind of turn, like that he has always been a very intelligent filmmaker, but it's, you know, it's hard to get taken seriously as an intelligent filmmaker with something to say when you're making like Rabid and Shivers. And it's kind of like, how long is the journey out that it feels like he sort of just decides to accelerate things in a way with Naked Lunch. Because there was that long period where it seemed like every time you turned around, he was at Cannes, and you were like, what? The guy who made those, like,
and he was,
Bug movies, or now he's at Cannes?
Yeah. Well, this is the luck of working with people he did when he did, and having government support, and so instantly being controversial in Canada, where we simply did not do such things. Like, Shivers is about the sexual revolution. It's just, it happens to have parasites in it, and people getting smashed in the head. But I saw Shivers... 2 years ago, I guess, when TIFF had its big Cronenberg restoration and retrospective, they had the restoration of Shivers, which had just been done in Quebec, maybe 3 years ago now. And it is amazing how solid a film that is. Like, given the opportunity to make his first feature and do it for the tax shelters and do it, basically all you needed was nudity and violence, and you could make any movie you wanted in Canada at that time, in Montreal especially, where he shot it. And he told a story that is, like, from scene to scene, really well put together, really smart, funny, clever, intelligent, takes its time revealing. Like, it's a movie. It's not it's not exploitation. It's a really interesting film. And he's, like, this fully formed intellect as a filmmaker.
Yeah.
And then he made Rabid, which is a fantastic zombie movie that predates, like, the fast zombie films of the 90s and present day. And then The Brood, which is his, like, you know, he calls it his Kramer versus Kramer because he was going through a divorce, and it's the externalization of all of that. And then Scanners, which is commercial, and then Videodrome, which is so not. And then the studio pictures, and then he just arrives at Naked Lunch, and it feels organic. But it feels like a turning point where it's like, this is... I showed you what I want, what I can do. I'm going to show you what I want to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there is that feeling that nobody in any room ever got listened to, and they said, you know, what's the target demographic for this? If he's be like, yeah, whatever.
We need a 4-quadrant hit.
Yeah,
this one has talking cockroach assholes. Oh well, then. can you make it less gay? No. Well, okay, let's just keep going. Like, it just keeps going. It will not stop to think about an audience's consideration, which makes it even more compelling, because
absolutely
it does not care what you
want. And in the context of a number of other films in English Canada, they're kind of treading similar territory, mm-hmm. right? I mean, what another thing, you know, another of the many things that is so fascinating about Cronenberg is that the history of his filmmaking, it becomes apparent when you read that book of his, is kind of the history of English-Canadian cinema. I mean, fiction narrative cinema, feature length, you know, which sort of gets reborn, whatever, in the late 60s. But he just, every time it sort of changes, and now it's tax shelters, and now it's, you know, whatever, these dentist films, and now it's sort of whatever else, he's there kind of leading the charge. And you sort of, by watching his films and reading his history, you sort of get a picture of how our film industry evolved.
Yeah, I mean, he demonstrated that it could be profitable. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't making meatballs. He wasn't making films that were co-productions or local shoots that then became studio babies. He made his own movies, and then he made studio films, and then he went back to making his own movies. But he is, like, he was right at the center of all of this, even starting in Montreal and then moving back to Toronto to shoot, to make his films the way he wanted to. He's been working with the same people for 40-odd years. Mm-hmm. He continues to draw talent. I'm less enamored of his most recent work, but there's still, like, History of Violence is among the best things he's ever done. It's just after that, it gets a little, almost a little staid. He's sort of drifted away from the fantastical, or even the, you know, like, the monster in A Dangerous Method is female sexuality infecting psychotherapy, which is fine, but it's sort of a defining the story as intellectual, and it doesn't really break beyond that.
Right.
Things like that, and I just don't think Maps to the Stars works at all, but I'm still going to show up for the next thing he does, because he is capable of doing literally anything he wants.
Yeah.
He puts his mind to it.
And
there really is nobody else. And you've got the closest person to compare him to is probably Norman Jewison, who was hugely successful in America and thus beloved in Canada, even though, you know, like, he only made one Canadian film, and it was The Statement. Everything else he may have shot here, but it was doing it for the US. And a director who is not particularly distinct in a vision. Like, you look at a Cronenberg movie, and there's no one else who could have made it, even Maps to the Stars. There's nobody else who could have made this movie that way.
Right.
And he is such a weird, iconic force in Canadian cinema that, like, I would imagine it's pretty intimidating to just step on that landscape as a filmmaker. Like, you've worked in a number of genres, mm-hmm. and, like, how does that, do you have to stop and make sure he hasn't done this first? Is there ever, like, is it intimidating?
Well, Cronenberg is, for sure. And it's weird that you don't see a lot of, you know, I mean, after Adam McGuigan, there were a bunch of, so, you know, pseudo mini Adam McGuigans,
right,
who kind of
chilly, grew,
and certainly in Winnipeg, you see a lot of people very influenced by Guy Maddin's work,
sure,
who are doing that. But I haven't really seen a bunch of mini Cronenbergs walking around in Canada, sort of trying to imitate the great master's work, which is interesting. I wonder if it's because he is so intimidating and singular in that sense.
It's possible. I mean, Toronto is such a small town for filmmaking that it is possible that people just go, he's going to get mad at me if I do this. But at the same time, if you try to knock off Cronenberg, you get Scanners too. Like, you get really bad misinterpretations.
Right.
I would maybe hold up Vincenzo Natali.
Right.
Because Splice is heavily Cronenbergian, to the point where it sort of plays with that once or twice. But it's also so clearly its own animal.
Yeah.
He has different obsessions and different interests, but he's the only other filmmaker in terms of genre who is working in sort of the same territory. And I think he also knows exactly where he is in relation to Cronenberg, and the two, there is a chasm that he will not, like, he doesn't want to cross. He'll be more absurd. He'll do stuff like Nothing, which nobody saw, but is delightful.
Right.
And he, you know, like, the work he did on Hannibal is actually pretty Cronenbergian.
Yeah.
In a weird way.
You know, Cronenberg takes you so, like, he right into the heart of the horror. Like, you're right in the middle of it. It's not chasing you. You're not hiding from it. You're not hoping it doesn't hear you breathing as it walks by.
Yeah.
Like, you're just in the middle of it. And I don't see a lot of other filmmakers, not just in Canada, anywhere, who are doing work at that level.
I wonder if it's simply an understanding, like, and this is something that Cronenberg totally gets, it's like an understanding of consequence. You know, like, everybody says that science, huge breakthroughs are never eureka moments. It's somebody going, oh, that's weird, and doubling, you know, like, doing the experiment again and seeing what happens when the thing grows on the bread, and following down this heart medication, which makes people have erections that last for 4 hours and have to call your doctor. And that's how discoveries happen. It's never, nobody wakes up and goes, this is the cure for, you know, dropsy. I don't even know what dropsy is. It's just funny.
It's something. I've heard of it.
It's a thing. It's definitely a thing. But with Cronenberg, it's the other thing. It's the accidental discovery of something truly awful. that becomes seductive. So it is, this is interesting. Oh, my fingernails are falling off, but let's see where this goes. Like, there's a sense of an embrace of change, forced or chosen, like embraced. And both of those things happen in Naked Lunch, because someone is profoundly altering his life because he's fucked up, but he's also getting fucked up to alter his life. So it's a weird synergy that is absolutely terrible for everyone around this guy, but he is pursuing it. He's following himself down the hole.
That's it. He's becoming.
Yeah.
Right. There's that act of becoming that is so central to a lot of Cronenberg's work.
Yeah. Like in Videodrome, it is not something anyone embraces. Like Max Wren is terrified and sickened and horrified to go through what he goes through until he becomes programmed to like it.
Yeah.
In The Fly, there's sort of a dementia that happens. I mean, the character even discusses it about how this is just, the fly's going to wake up and the man is going to go away. And then you have Scanners, where the two sides of this power are represented by the two characters. And then you have Naked Lunch, where all of it is contained inside Peter Weller's deadpan.
Yeah.
And somehow the movie lets us see it. Like, we can read him even when he's doing nothing.
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, one of my favorite lines in the film to describe the experience of the film is his typewriter talks to him and says, you know, you've been doing this for us and you've been doing that for us.
Yeah.
And Peter Weller's like, what? I have no memory of any of that. And the typewriter says, well, an unconscious agent is the very best kind of agent.
Yeah.
Such a great line. Like, you sort of watch the film and you're like, right, that's what's happening. That's what I'm watching.
Yeah. And of course, if he is nodding off, like calling the heroin addiction is on the nod, right? So he is literally a sleeper agent. He just, he doesn't get it. We don't get it at first. Just the images that he's processing are clearly some sort of hallucination, but maybe they're just real. Maybe it's all just there. I mean, God knows, I've met mugwumps. We saw them in fiberglass cast in the exhibit and in the light box at the time. I have a photograph of myself with one. It's the most normal thing in the world to sit down at a stage next to that thing because the movie said it was okay. I saw it. It must be real.
And the way that it's introduced.
Yeah.
Oh, I have a friend of mine you'd like to meet. He turns and there's that mugwump sitting in the bar, and Weller's reaction, which isn't...
Yeah.
It's just nothing.
He's not horrified. He's not laughing. And the same thing played in the theater with us. We were just like, all right. What does it do? What's it going to do now? Where is this movie going to take us? And it took people places that they didn't necessarily want to go and weren't necessarily ready for. It was received with great fervor by critics and some audience members, but generally it was, I mean, I remember the coverage at the time where it was a lot of people just sort of saying, oh, it's that weird movie. He made a weird movie.
Right.
And that was somehow the end of the discussion. All of his movies are weird movies. You can't just dismiss them. But people were not quite ready to put it in the canon, I would say, for a while. It was the thing he made after the conventional movies.
Right.
And then M. Butterfly, which when it played at TIFF was just sort of received as an, oh yeah, okay.
Right.
He went back to working with irons. He picked a more normal frame. It's not. I mean,
no.
The film's seething with weirdness, but it's all sublimated. So with Naked Lunch, it all comes out. And then M. Butterfly, almost exactly the same story. It's about a man deluding himself into being someone else.
Yeah.
And believing in alternate reality, which I think it's undermined a little bit by the casting of John Lone, simply because he looks so masculine, as opposed to what B.D. Wong did on stage, where you can... You know, you're far removed. Film is much more unforgiving. You are much less forgiving. You're stuck there with him. And you can tell this is a dude.
Yeah.
But it almost doesn't matter because Irons plays it so flatly again. Like, he's... Not flatly. He plays it so nonchalantly that, of course, this is a woman because I want her to be.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. Like, it's the same dynamic. It's almost the same arc.
Right.
It just ends far more tragically. Because it has to, because it's an opera, because it's stylized in the end. And Naked Lunch doesn't give you that. Naked Lunch is jazz. Naked Lunch doesn't stop where you want it to stop, and it doesn't start where you want it to start, because then you would make more sense of it.
Right.
But you're just bouncing through it, and, you know, let's see where we go.
Yeah. No, yeah, exactly. Like jazz and like the books themselves, right?
Yeah.
It's just this happens, and then that happens, then this happens, or does it?
Yeah. Something's happening. and again, the casting is something he's always been able to do, is get remarkable actors and use them precisely as they should be. I mean, James Woods was a little squirrely guy when he made Videodrome. He hadn't really been in anything truly I guess he made The Onion field by that point, but I'm thinking about the way he was using stuff like Eyewitness, where he just sort of turned up. He was a character actor.
Yeah.
And put him in Videodrome, and you cannot look away. He is magnetic in his squirrely weirdness. Walking Dead Zone, I don't know that he's ever been better.
Right. Yeah, he's fantastic.
It is, and he's playing a romantic lead, which he never got to do.
Mm-hmm.
But Cronenberg's just like, yep, you can do this. And he can.
Yeah.
You get, like, the Sheen was fantastic in that film. Like, everybody he's worked with, in Goldblum and Davis, and even John Getz in The Fly, like, everybody. It's a three-character piece, and they're all great. And then this gives you Peter Weller in a way that you really haven't seen him before, but kind of defines him for the next 10 years of his career. Like,
oh, did it really?
I think so. Like, he made The New Age after that with Davis.
Right.
Their bizarre little reunion. This Michael Tolkien film that nobody remembers. I don't even know if it's on DVD. I know I have the Laserdisc. I just found it the other day. But it's one of those performances where it shows you a new angle on the actor.
Yeah.
And, you know, after RoboCop, he chose to do, and he made that terrible Sam Elliott movie, Shakedown, around the same time, but he chose to work with Cronenberg and just kills it. He is just so good.
He is, yeah.
And you feel this confidence in that the film has in him, that it knows he can do anything. And so he does nothing. Like, it ratchets him all the way down to this incredible minimalist performance. I mean, I think there is a laugh when he moves his eyes at one point, just kind of shifts his gaze.
This is it. And it's kind of a Herculean effort to be so minimal in the face of what that movie throws at him, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of a massive, big acting job as opposed to being minimal. There's a lot of times you hear this phrase that, this actor can really carry a feature. You know, this actor really carries this movie. But you watch the movie and, you know, they've got them running through the rain in a wide shot with a big symphonic score to express that they're sad. And you're like, well, how much is that actor really carrying this movie?
He's the star. That's how that works.
Exactly. But in this case, I mean, it really is like Weller carries that film.
Yeah.
Right. Without that exact pitch perfect performance, it's a very different movie.
Yeah. No, what he does with his, like what he does with his shoulder pads, what he does with his hat, like, it's all craft.
Mm.
And it's amazing. I've never actually gotten to talk to him. He's one of those guys on the list where there are three or four iconic roles that I would love. Like, there's this and Banzai, and it sounds stupid, but of unknown origin. This is an awful Canadian film. Canadian Tax Shelter picture, directed by George P. Cosmatos, before Rambo or just after.
Right.
Where he is an architect who tears his house apart because he's convinced there's a rat in the wall. And that's it. That's the movie.
That's the film.
He alienates his family and he drives his wife crazy or his girlfriend, and finally it is a monster rat. And it is, again, one guy doing one thing for the entire film. He does this feverish commitment, and that's the role. But it's mesmerizing. It's not a good movie.
Right.
And Cosmatos does him no favors with the framing, and he makes him look all sweaty and weird. But he throws himself in so fully that it became thrilling to watch him yell at puppets. Like, it doesn't matter what's going on. You're there for the performance, and it's incredibly compelling. And it's just, this guy is losing his mind, and the actor is committing to this incremental slide into mania. And it's like, nobody knows about it. I think it's come out on DVD in some weird Warner quadruple box of weird, you know, like, here are some monster movies we think you might be able to buy together.
Right.
It has no place in any discussion of serious cinema. It's not a good film. And they reshot the ending, and the monster rat is just dumb. But he's great. Like, he does not condescend to the material, and at no point does he kind of wink to the monster. It's Kurt Russell in The Thing. You buy it.
Right.
And now let's see what happens. And I want to believe on some level that that was what told Cronenberg that he could do it, that he could be his Bill Lee.
He saw the film and he was like, this is the guy who can...
You can act with puppets and you can sell that.
Yeah.
Let's see what you do with a mugwump, and we're going to get a little weird.
Right. Yeah, I get a little weird, but you're just going to be like, yep. And we hope that the audience will... that'll get them halfway there.
Yeah, because it's the opposite of what he does in Naked Lunch. He's not blasé at all. He is not playing the cool of it. Mm-hmm. He is frenzied and unhinged. But I can't believe I'm actually talking about this thing 30 years later. It's not a movie you would remember except for the actor in it.
Hmm.
Of unknown origin.
Right.
Not good. But Peter Weller is fantastic. If anybody wants to come on and defend Of Unknown Origin, good luck finding it. He is to the film. He is as important to the film as Cronenberg is, I think.
For sure.
And then there's the rest of the actors who are all really great. and somehow fluid in my mind. I always forget Judy Davis is in as much of the film as she is.
Right.
Because to my mind, she drops out after the first reel. Except, of course, she keeps coming back.
Yes. Yeah, but, she keeps coming back. But all of them play it so straight.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting. Look at Ian Holm's character. And I mean, we love that guy in everything that he's in. And, you know, there's, you know, all sorts of monsters and drug addiction and sodomy and aliens happening all over the place. And he gets upset when his typewriter gets broken.
Yeah.
Like, it's the only moment in the film where he gets really, really upset.
It
suddenly makes it all so mundane.
Yeah.
Right?
It's almost the kind of thing that, I mean, it's clearly scripted and it's part of the structure of the film, but it feels like a choice by a method actor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the guy who won't put down the cigarette or the guy who refuses to stop flipping through a book. It's just this weird little piece of fixation that feels so human and real that you buy the rest of it. Because, of course, well, yeah, it was his typewriter. He really liked it. And what Roy Scheider does, which is so weird and gleeful and just, I think he knew, like, he could peacock it because he's in the last 10 minutes and you can do whatever the hell you want at this point because we're acclimatized.
Absolutely.
To whatever is going on. And then to have him just show up and do basically Fosse again, just pop, literally appear in the film.
Yeah, but although it must have been, I wonder if it was tricky for him to have to play, you know, because all the other characters get to sort of start at zero and go to 10.
Yeah.
But he is in the first reel as a doctor prescribing medicine where it's just a very minimal performance. You feel like he's barely even noticing Weller in the scene. He's giving him some drugs, writing a prescription, and that's it. And then suddenly he has to appear as the same character, somehow tied together with some sort of mannerisms or something. But
yeah, but be the lurid puppet master at the heart of it all. Yeah. I mean, if you buy into the idea that this is Lee's paranoid realization of things, then yeah, he's not the same. Like, this is everybody in the last 80 minutes of the movie is a version that he's just invented for himself to play with.
Right.
Or to be distracted by or to console himself with. And the idea that, and this comes out of Burroughs, I think, the idea that you yourself are the result of somebody else screwing with you, either literally or figuratively, is very comforting to Bill Lee. Not so much in the movie, because, oh, this is happening. Like, it's just this one more goddamn thing, and now it's... not only have you witnessed the poor Kiki being consumed by the Julian Sands puppet, which I don't even know how to pull that off. It is such a Lovecraftian image.
Yeah.
Of this osmosis consumption, absorption of a human being by another human being that isn't really a human being anymore. And it's the one puppet effect that shouldn't work at all. But because of the way we're drawn into it, because we only get to glimpse it here and there through the bars and the light and the shadow, and then we're confronted with the puppet. And by that point, it's just like, yep, it's happening.
Yeah.
And then to come out of that and get the Benway jokes is just like, oh, I'm the architect of your misfortune, and I'm going to just introduce myself by unzipping another person. Why not? You can't go big enough.
Yeah.
You cannot be big enough at that point.
Yeah, well, that's it.
That gives us the sort of exhausted, bleary Lee that comes out, that leaves and goes to Anexia, because after that, where do you go? Like, what can't you see?
Right.
What haven't you experienced at that point?
You absolutely need to
tunnel your way home.
Yeah. It was great to have the chance to pick it and then revisit it again after so many years and just kind of the cinematic pleasures that abound in that film.
It really is. Like, it feels like you're sort of pogo sticking through a garden.
Yeah.
And a lot of really ugly things underneath it, but you keep moving fast enough and you're not going to have to confront them. It's such a... Yeah, it flows. And then the details in Naked Lunch are more amorphous. I remember it. I know it all.
Mm-hmm.
But things don't happen where I remember them happening.
Right.
They're all over the place.
It's you know, because Burroughs always said that the book could be read in any order.
Yeah, he's created a cut-up of a film that hasn't... Like, the film is fixed. The film hasn't changed. And yet, it views differently in my head than any of the other Cronenberg films. It's the one that moves around the most.
Yeah, in many senses, I mean, the chronology of it, I mean, in broad strokes, of course, is important.
Mm-hmm.
But in the details, it's not, you know, it's not that important, really. Some of those scenes you feel like they could have moved around and the experience would be almost the same of watching the film, which is Burroughs.
Yeah, yeah. It's remarkable, again, how faithful it is despite being completely... its own animal.
Yeah.
It manages to give you the experience of the experience without forcing you to experience it in exactly the same form.
Yeah, which is amazing. Yeah, and it's amazing how those films do, because I was thinking about Dead Ringers, again, which is, I think, one that I've seen also 5 or 6 times. Mm-hmm. Just over the years, you end up bumping it on wherever and watching it again. There's a scene where the one brother has that profane tirade.
Oh, yeah.
Accepting
the award.
Yes, yeah, at the lunch. And then the other brother comes and says, clearly he's been celebrating, and who can blame him?
Yeah.
And it makes everything okay.
Yeah.
And there's polite applause afterwards. Weird. That just always stuck with me. This moment of something about the authority of the white doctor with the British accent just making it go away.
It is a uniquely Canadian scene, too. Like, everybody's really uncomfortable, but they still clap.
Yeah.
Like that wouldn't happen in the States. There'd be more discomfort. Or in England, there'd be no... Like, it would just hang. But you're right. Yeah. It's the foreign presence... Which, you know, it goes back, and he's used it before, but never as the leads, like Patrick McGoohan in Scanners as the mad scientist who still speaks with such authority, even though he's clearly crazy. Oliver Reed in The Brute. This is a long history for him.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm the doctor, the untrustworthy authority doctor.
But this is what happens in Dead Ringers, that these are the heroes.
Yeah.
These are the guys that you're stuck with, and you kind of have to root for them, because otherwise they're going to die all alone and sad. And if we're there, at least it's not quite so bad.
Right.
And in Naked Lunch, it's the same thing. Like, you're there with Bill Lee as he digs his way into whatever he's digging his way into and then out of. But we're also there for the birth of this work of art, and we're witnessing it through the film. And then the film is the work of art as well. Like, it's a secondary construction that feels like the primary.
Yeah,
it's a rabbit hole. I can't get out of it. It's one of those things that continues to fascinate me. How the hell did he pull this off?
That is what it is, right? When you, like, it's one thing to sort of pick through it and unravel it and look at it, but to imagine the mind behind it that was seemingly so clear-headed. Yeah. Oh yeah, this is how I'll do it. There's just like an unfathomably giant intellect behind this movie.
Yeah, it's a construction job, but it's incredibly daunting. It's like building, I don't know, a Gehry building with no, like, how does that even stay up? I have no idea.
Yeah. But
I'm in it, and it's great.
And it's great. I mean, and of course, Cronenberg, partly because he's Cronenberg, but just, you know, a lot of movies that take you weird, dark places, you know, along the way, I find that there are moments where I start doubting the storyteller.
Okay.
And where they're taking me.
Yeah.
And not for 1 second does that occur in this film, right? I mean, you're just, it's all so confident.
Yeah. So then the closing question is always the same on the show. What of the film, if anything, have you used yourself or been inspired by or just absorbed into your own DNA?
Again, it was the thing that I mentioned at the beginning. It's the idea of the adaptation. You know, I've always believed, of course, that the filmmaker is the primary architect of any film. Mm. A lot of collaborators, but basically the filmmaker is the person who makes it. And in doing that, you take source material in the case of an adaptation, and you have to change it to make it work. And so I've always done that. And sometimes you rub people the wrong way when you do it. But I mean, Naked Lunch for me has always been the model.
Yeah.
Of how, you know, you take it and you turn it around, you turn it upside down, you take pieces of it and you throw bits away that don't seem to work and adapt it to the form that it's being adapted into. And so, yeah, that's always a thing that I have sort of stuck to and referred to. And even in this film, we adapted a short film for Borealis to make the feature. And even though it was my own short film, you know, I'm just very conscious of the fact that we're now turning it into a feature. So everything that I maybe loved and had emotional attachments to in the short film gets discarded if it doesn't work.
Really? So
for the adaptation.
What did you... I don't want to go into spoiler territory for people who haven't seen the film, but what did you discover in the process of that adaptation? Was there anything that, in the feature that germinated exclusively from that?
Tons of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, the short film... Short films work very different. They have very different narrative demands on their stories and on their characters and their character development and all that sort of stuff. And so the short film was very much about kind of a hero father giving a gift to his daughter, this road trip and, you know, where it ends up. And then, of course, the return, you know, the ending, how it sort of turns on itself.
Right.
That was sort of all part of the short film. But in the feature, you know, a sort of a valiant saint-like hero father... It's not going to work. I mean, that kind of character doesn't work in a feature.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They're uninteresting. And so we completely had to take that character apart and reconstruct him as a very flawed, very difficult character that it takes us a long time to learned to get close to.
Yeah, I have not seen the short, and I'm really curious to see how he would have been.
Yeah, totally different. Framed,
'cause that totally different. Yeah, guy. Nothing in the film would lead me to believe that he could be a saint-like. It's a redemption story, if anything.
But yes. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And you know, and so yeah, it very much as the author of it, you know, as the director. When I was making the short film, I was the girl.
Okay.
Right? I mean...
Sure, yeah.
But when I'm making the feature, I'm the dad.
All right. Yeah, that's an excellent way to put it, actually. Because, yeah, that's... I mean, the focus in the film, in the feature, is definitely the two of them. But it's... One character is the agitator, is the person who makes things happen, and the other one is much more passive. I mean, she does things... Now I'm spoiling it. One character does things from... Oh, I can't even do it without gender pronouns. She does things that further her own story, but he does things that further both of theirs.
Yeah.
I think that's fair.
For sure.
Wow, cool. Well, now I want to see the short, too.
Yeah, so I think it's on iTunes.
All right.
It's findable. It's out there.
Also titled Borealis?
Called Blind.
Blind, people. Go find Blind on iTunes and go find Borealis theatrically now, right?
In theaters, yeah, starting April 8th.
Excellent.
My thanks to Sean Garrity, whose new film Borealis opens in Toronto this Friday, April 8th, and expands across the country in the coming weeks. You can also find My Awkward Sexual Adventure and Blood Pressure on Netflix Canada right now. You can find Sean on Twitter at Garrity Winnipeg, all one word, and you can find Naked Lunch in a customarily excellent special edition on Blu-ray and DVD from the Criterion Collection, although it's an import in Canada. That's ironic. It's also available for rental and purchase on iTunes and Google Play, but only in Canada. And if you want to see those early student films we mentioned, Stereo is included on Criterion's Scanners, and Crimes of the Future is on Criterion's The Brood, both in new digital restorations. You can also find standard definition transfers of both Stereo and Crimes of the Future on the Blue Underground Blu-ray edition of Cronenberg's Fast Company. I know, it's complicated. And as always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner, and elsewhere on the internet at nowtoronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at someoneelsesmovie.com. And if you want to leave a review on iTunes, this week's phrase is mugwump... No, scratch that. Let's go with bug powder. It's safer for everyone. Thanks for listening.
I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.